Well, in our Sunday evening sermons right now, then, we are looking at various human relationships. And we're doing so not merely in some abstract fashion, we are focusing on specific biblical case studies. And so, in our first session last week, we looked at a professional relationship, the one between Nehemiah and Artaxerxes. And this evening, then, we're going to be looking at a covenant relationship. That's our title this evening, a covenant relationship, and it's the one between David and Jonathan. Now, I suppose that whenever we think about David and Jonathan, the word which immediately springs to our minds is probably the word friends. In Tolkien's famous trilogy, we have Frodo and Sam. In J.K. Rowling's epic series, we have Harry and Ron. In Anthony Buckridge's classics, we have Jennings and Derbyshire. And David and Jonathan then seem like the Bible's equivalent. Okay, this relationship is historical, not fictional like the others, but surely, in a very similar sense, what we have here is a relationship of two outstanding friends. But in actual fact, you may be surprised to realize that the Bible never uses the language of friendship in connection with David and Jonathan. The NIV does on one occasion, we read it actually in our passage this evening, but the Hebrew text never uses the language of friendship in connection with these two men. Instead, the Bible majors on the language of covenant. Within 1 Samuel, there are at least five explicit references. I think there are more implicit references, but there are at least five explicit references to the covenant bond which existed between these two men. Now, I'm not saying that David and Jonathan weren't friends, that it's somehow inappropriate or wrong to talk about them in that way. Nor am I saying that friendship generally lies beyond the scope of biblical teaching. That's certainly not the case. There's a good deal of spirit-inspired ink spilt on this subject. The Bible portrays, for instance, the beauty of friendship. Proverbs 27, verse 9. Perfume and incense bring joy to the heart, and the pleasantness of one's friend springs from his earnest counsel. The Bible portrays the robustness of friendship. Proverbs 27, verse 6. Wounds from a friend can be trusted. And the Bible portrays, too, the dangers of friendship. Arguably the most depressing episode in the whole David story is in 2 Samuel chapter 13, where his son Amnon becomes infatuated with Tamar and ends up in a quite premeditated fashion raping that woman. And if you ask, how could he do such a thing? How could this privileged son of David sit there in his room and carefully plan out a base sexual assault? How could he contemplate violating an innocent and defenseless girl? The narrator tells us he was under the influence, not under the influence of drink or of drugs, but under the influence of a friend, a man called Jonadab. And it was him who planted this wretched idea in Amnon's mind. It's a warning to us all, isn't it, about friendship and that it can be a dangerous thing. I know that some of you have some brilliant relationships with non-Christian friends, and I thank God for that. That's a great thing. That over the years, those people have had such constant exposure to the transforming power of Jesus Christ in your life. That's a fantastic thing, and I wouldn't want to undermine it for a single moment. But we do need to check ourselves, don't we? That we aren't being adversely influenced by Jonadabs, friends who are taking us to places which, as Christians, we'd be better off not going to. Friends who are involving us in activities which, as Christians, we'd be better off not getting involved in. Friends in whose company, perhaps, we behave in ways in which we would never behave when amongst Christians. Friends whose effect upon us is more unhealthy than ours upon them is healthy. So I'm not trying to minimize at all then the biblical importance of friendship. What I am saying, however, is that when it comes to David and Jonathan, the Bible emphasizes something else. It emphasizes covenant. It emphasizes the formal and solemn promises which these men have sworn to one another. Let me put it like this. How do you measure how healthy a friendship is? How do you measure how healthy a friendship is? Is it about how often the two persons in question see each other or speak to each other? Is it about how well they remember each other's birthdays? Is it about how much their ideas and interests overlap? How do you measure how healthy a friendship is? There are people in my life whom I only speak to perhaps 3 or 4 times a year. I see them even less. I haven't the foggiest when their birthdays are. And yet I would call them friends. Perhaps to you that seems ridiculous. But I'm saying then that there are no really objective criteria, are there, for measuring the health of a friendship. But you see, that's what's different about the relationship between David and Jonathan. Because this is a covenant relationship built upon promises, it's clearly measurable in terms of faithfulness to those promises. So that in the last analysis, David and Jonathan's relationship is an outstanding relationship, not because of the natural affinity between them or because of the spiritual connectedness between them or anything like that. It's an outstanding relationship because they are faithful to the promises which they have exchanged. And that means, I think, that the David and Jonathan relationship has a very wide-ranging applicableness for us this evening. Because, of course, many of our relationships are built upon promises, aren't they? The marriage relationship is built upon promises. Husbands and wives make formal commitments to one another. Professional relationships, going back to what we were talking about last week, they often involve promises. Employers and employees formally commit themselves to each other. Church relationships involve promises. Church members formally commit themselves to the life of the fellowship of God's people. And so I'm saying then that we are called as Christians to exercise a David and Jonathan-esque faithfulness in all kinds of different contexts. And so this evening then, in the remainder of our time, I would like us to learn some of the lessons about faithfulness which I think emerge from this David and Jonathan relationship. Some lessons which these two men can teach us about, not about friendship per se, but about faithfulness, which, as I say, applies to many of our relationships. And bearing in mind as we do this that we won't learn these lessons from 21st century British society around us. It's surely one virtue which more than most is neglected and dilapidated in our society today, isn't it? Faithfulness. We live in a society where it almost retains no meaning whatsoever. And so to exercise then a David and Jonathan-esque faithfulness is not only a biblical responsibility, but in our context, it's a profoundly countercultural phenomenon. So let's see then what lessons we can learn about faithfulness from this particular biblical relationship. Well, the first lesson these two men teach us is that faithfulness is costly. Faithfulness is costly. We read earlier on 1 Samuel chapter 20. If you've still got that open in front of you, you might just want to flick back a page or two to 1 Samuel chapter 18, because it's in 1 Samuel 18 that this covenant relationship between these two men is inaugurated. And we read there then that this is in the immediate aftermath of David's great conquest, which we touched upon this morning, of the Philistine giant Goliath. And we read then that in that the aftermath of that, David and Jonathan, who is of course the son of King Saul, they enter into this covenant relationship. And we read in verse four something which may at first seem a little bit strange. We may not really understand what's going on here. We read in verse 3 that Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And then verse 4, Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow and his belt. What is going on here? Why at this point of covenant inauguration does Jonathan give his robe to David? Well, I think the significance of this action actually derives from a slightly earlier passage. If you want to flick back another page or two, back to chapter 15. And in chapter 15 and verses 27 to 28, this is where things are starting to go seriously pear-shaped for Saul's kingship. It had all started so well. Now things are going pear-shaped. And we read there, chapter 15, verses 27 and 28, as Samuel turned to leave, that's to leave Saul, Saul caught hold of the hem of his robe, and it tore. Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you." And you see then how in that passage, a robe kind of symbolizes the kingdom of Israel. The torn robe here equals the torn kingdom of Israel, the kingdom being torn away from Saul and from Saul's house. And I think that the same symbolism then is now being transferred here to chapter 18. Here it's not now a torn robe, it's a surrendered robe, as Jonathan surrenders his robe to David, as he hands it over to him. It's symbolizing Jonathan surrendering the kingdom to David and saying, "David, the kingdom of Israel is yours." And of course, that is a very pregnant and meaningful thing, because Jonathan is the natural heir of the kingdom of Israel. Jonathan is the son of the current king. Jonathan, to all human perception, is the heir apparent. Jonathan is the natural person who will inherit Israel. And so it's deeply significant, therefore, for him here to be handing the kingdom over to David. But you see, he's doing that because he realized that God has chosen David. He appreciates that God has transferred his affections, transferred his choice from the house of Saul to a new house, that he's chosen David as the next king. And here then in chapter 18, by handing over the robe to David, Jonathan is basically saying, "I'm complying with that completely. I'm going along with that altogether. I'm acquiescing totally and submissively with this choice which God has made. God has chosen you, not me, to be the next king. And I am absolutely submitting to that divine choice." And so that really is, from Jonathan's side of things, that's what the covenant is about. It's about Jonathan saying, "Look, I'm submitting to your future kingship. I'm not setting myself up as any rival. There's not going to be some two-horse race from now on. Some race as to who's going to be the next king. No, I'm leaving the way open for you. You're going to be the next king." From Jonathan's end of things, that's really what this covenant was about. But you see, it's one thing for Jonathan on a one-off occasion, in a noble moment, to make that commitment, isn't it? To say, "Look, you're going to be the next king, and I'm fine with that." It's one thing for him, in a one-off incident, to be like that and to adopt that attitude. It's another thing to then, having sworn that, to maintain that commitment and to be faithful to that commitment. To be faithful to it when he wakes up in the middle of the night and he's been dreaming about having himself royal authority and royal dignity one day. It's another thing altogether in that moment to say, no, David's going to be the future king, and I've sworn myself to comply with that. Or more seriously still, when his own father, Saul, is piling the pressure on him, which is exactly what he does, you remember, in that passage that we read there in chapter 18. You remember how, chapter 20, you remember how Saul there, in the middle of that feast at which David is absent, you remember how he just loses it and goes mad with his son, Jonathan. And you remember how he says to him then in verse 31, as long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. And Saul then is really trying to, is really sticking the knife in there, isn't he? And saying, look, forget the son of Jesse. And think about your own interests and think about your own entitlement to the future kingdom. And I'm saying then it's one thing for Jonathan there in chapter 18 to be all humble and say, no, David, you're going to be the next king. And I'm swearing myself here to go along with that. It's another thing for him there in chapter 20 when his own dad is saying, what are you doing? For him still to maintain this faithfulness to the covenant he has made with David. But that's what he does. And so I'm saying then for Jonathan, faithfulness was costly. It was against, as we would think, his own best interests. From any political perspective, from any career perspective, it was against his own best interests to maintain faithfulness to this covenant he'd sworn with David. And faithfulness is nearly always costly, isn't it? I mentioned a moment ago that it's an undermined and neglected and dilapidated virtue in our society today. Why is that so? Well, isn't it precisely because we're such a self-indulgent, self-centered society? And the two things are mutually exclusive. Where self-centeredness prevails, faithfulness won't. Because faithfulness always entails personal inconveniences and personal costs. And for a society then that operates on the kind of advertisements that you and I see around us on the billboards and on the television, advertisements that are appealing directly to a self-centeredness within us, that kind of society is not going to have a very high premium on faithfulness. But faithfulness, as I say, will nearly always be costly. Marital faithfulness will incur a cost. It's one thing on that wonderful wedding day when everything's so splendid and so exciting. It's one thing on that day to be saying to that spouse that I'm going to be with you and I'm going to be for you for the rest of my life. But what about all those decades later, when that spouse is perhaps confined to the home, when that spouse perhaps has some degenerative disease, when that spouse perhaps has lost his or her mental faculties and is barely recognisable as the person you stood next to at the front of that church, when that spouse presents all kinds of inconveniences to the fabric of your daily life, faithfulness then to those vows and those pledges is costly. Church membership faithfulness is also costly. Structuring your weekly timetable around the gatherings, the public meetings of the church, as we all commit ourselves to do when we become members, entails a certain inconvenience and a certain cost at times. Committing ourselves to regularly setting aside time to pray for our brothers and sisters within the fellowship, as again we have all done as church members, entails a certain inconvenience and cost. Just being there for one another and involved in one another's lives being at the end of the phone for one another, as we have at least implicitly committed ourselves to be, again entails a certain inconvenience and cost. I think I've quoted before this line from Dale Ralph Davis, which I found tremendously powerful in its import, and it's worth therefore re-quoting. He says this: life does not consist in achieving your goals, but in fulfilling your promises. Life does not consist in achieving your goals, but in fulfilling your promises. Again, does that not just completely invert everything that our society stands for today? Where everything is about achieving your goals. And if you have to hurt others, and if you have to betray others, and if you have to cheat on others, and if you have to disappoint others and let others down in order to achieve those goals, then so be it. You've only got one life. You better make sure that you achieve those goals while you're still here on earth. But no, for the Christian, life isn't about achieving your goals. Life is about fulfilling your promises, about keeping those commitments you've made. And that, as I say, will inevitably entail a cost and an inconvenience. It certainly did for Jonathan. For him, being faithful to the covenant he made with David in chapter 18 meant saying goodbye to any hopes of being Israel's king. That's a big cost. A cost his father just could not understand. What about you and your kingdom? But that was the cost that David was prepared to incur. So faithfulness is costly. Secondly, this evening, faithfulness is definitive. Faithfulness is definitive. Definitive of what, you ask? Well, definitive of love. Faithfulness defines what love is. Now, in saying that, I'm probably overstating things somewhat. Love is more, I suppose, than faithfulness. But faithfulness, certainly, from a biblical perspective, is a very large part, if not the largest part, of what love is. And if that sounds surprising and striking to us this evening, again, is it not because we've been so influenced by our culture? We've been so influenced by the messages that we receive every time we watch a Hollywood film, where love is feelings. Love is something you fall into and potentially fall back out of. Love is this often very physical and very visceral kind of attraction. And that's why then I think we probably feel somewhat uncomfortable when it comes to one particular aspect of this David and Jonathan relationship, and one particular passage, 2 Samuel chapter 1. This is where Jonathan has died. Jonathan and his father Saul have died on the battlefield, you remember, in battle with the Philistines. And you remember how David receives the news of Saul and Jonathan's deaths, and he's very cut up about it all. He's deeply saddened by this report, and he immediately then writes a lament. A lament for these fallen soldiers. And he talks about Saul, but in particular he talks about Jonathan. And we read then in verse 26, David saying, "I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women." And perhaps we read that and we feel somewhat uncomfortable, and certainly some have tried to make the fatuous insinuation that there's some kind of homosexual relationship going on here, which of course does not remotely bear any scrutiny at all. But I think, as I say, we feel uncomfortable with it because we're thinking of love in a very modern Hollywood kind of way. But David here is thinking of love in terms of faithfulness. And when he says then that Jonathan's love was more precious to him and greater than the love of any woman in his life, he means that David showed more faithfulness to him than any woman in his life did. And that's true. I suppose that David's main experience of marriage at this point was through Saul's daughter Michal, and we know that that was a very tense and difficult relationship. David hadn't experienced great faithfulness from his wife Michal, and yet he'd experienced great faithfulness from Jonathan. This costly faithfulness I've already talked about. Even though Jonathan was saying no to the kingship, he'd remained so faithful to David. And that's what David then is bearing tribute to there in his lament in chapter 1. And it's also then when we understand this, when we understand that love is faithfulness, basically, that we can understand all those biblical exhortations to love each other within the church of Jesus Christ. Because perhaps we read those kind of exhortations and we think, well, there's so many people that I know in the church who are so different to me and with whom I don't kind of naturally click. People who have very different interests and very different backgrounds. And I wouldn't kind of instinctively kind of pick up the phone and have a long chat with that person. And yet the Bible's telling me to love them. Well, how can I love them? Well, it's love, again, according to this biblical definition of faithfulness, of being faithful to the obligations you've made. As I say, you've made those obligations to pray for those other people in the church, to be concerned for them, to seek their spiritual good, to seek their spiritual edification in every conversation you have. And every contact you have. And when you're faithful to those obligations, then that's love. It's nothing to do with kind of having similar personalities and having a natural chemistry and a natural affinity between you. It's about being faithful to those obligations that explicitly or implicitly have been made between you. We need, I'm saying, a complete re-education as people so steeped in this culture, which is so anti-Christian, or so un-Christian, I should say, in its very bent. We need a re-education. We need to understand what terms in the Bible mean, what love means. It isn't about feelings, primarily. Feelings, of course, may often be involved in love, and that's a precious and important thing too. But feelings are not part of the definition of love. Faithfulness, however, is. So faithfulness is costly. Faithfulness is definitive. Thirdly, faithfulness is mundane. Faithfulness is mundane. We've seen then what this covenant relationship meant from Jonathan's end of it. Jonathan's responsibility was to comply with David as the new heir apparent, David as the new future king. That was Jonathan's responsibility within this covenant. What was David's responsibility? Did David have any responsibilities? Was all the burden resting on Jonathan's ends? Well, no, it wasn't. We read, don't we, of Jonathan articulating a responsibility for David there in chapter 20, the passage we read earlier on. We read in verse 14 of 1 Samuel 20, this is Jonathan saying to David, "Show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord." That's an amazing thing in itself, isn't it? "Like that of the Lord, as long as I live, so that I may not be killed, and do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." So that then was David's responsibility in this covenant. David's responsibility was to seek the preservation of Jonathan's life once he'd become king. Of course, at this stage, Jonathan was presumably envisaging that he would live during David's kingship in the event he didn't. He died in that battle, as we've just said. But not only that, the extended responsibility on David's part then was also to look after Jonathan's family. And that then is not just a note which is introduced into the biblical narrative and then never picked up on. It is picked up on, isn't it? If you know the David story, you'll be aware of how it's picked up on in 2 Samuel and chapter 9. And by this point then, David is king and quite established now as king. Indeed, it's remarkable that in the previous chapter, in chapter 8, you'll notice the NIV heading there is David's victories. And in that chapter, it's as if David is indeed kind of cutting off all his enemies from the face of the earth. And it's as if in doing that, something triggers in his mind. Here I am, and I've now cut off all my enemies from the face of the earth. Ah, didn't Jonathan in our covenant mention something about cutting off your enemies from the face of the earth? And what you were to do once you'd done that, you were to look after Jonathan's family. And so he immediately then begins to turn his attention to Jonathan's family, and he asks a question in verse 1, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? And you'll know how the story goes then, how there is this one chap, this man, Mephibosheth. And so David then, in keeping with the terms of this covenant he'd made with Jonathan all those years earlier, probably 15, 20 years earlier, David now does indeed show kindness to this man, Mephibosheth. Now, this Mephibosheth, he was a pathetic individual. He was a cripple, not from birth, but from infancy. You remember the sad circumstances in which he'd become a cripple. It was in that battle in which Jonathan had died. And he'd been dropped in the emergency, the panic of the situation, and he had become a cripple for the rest of his days. He's a sad and pathetic individual. And looking after him and kind of making sure that he's fed each day at the king's own table, it's hardly the glamorous work that we associate with kingship, is it? It's hardly spectacular stuff. It's very mundane, very banal, making sure a cripple is fed every day. And yet David does that. And David sees to that very rigorously and very diligently because he's been faithful to that covenant he had made with Jonathan. And again, faithfulness, just as it's often costly, it's often mundane, isn't it? Go back again to last week. Think of Nehemiah. And Nehemiah's constant cheerfulness that we commented on in serving King Artaxerxes, so that on that one day when he wasn't cheerful, it was so strikingly noticeable to his boss. And again, that was mundane stuff, just making sure that every day he was approaching his daily employment in a right spirit. Nothing glamorous about that. But Nehemiah felt obliged to Artaxerxes, to serve him in that way. He'd contracted himself to be the best possible wine taster for his employer. And although it was mundane, although it was banal, he therefore set about making sure every day, every single day, he approached his work, his employment, in a right spirit. And for the Christian then, that means tomorrow morning, going into that workplace, that office, that factory, that classroom, wherever it might be. And however miserable and glum and complaining your colleagues might be, and however unprepared they may be to put in a really hard day's work, it means you doing that because you're obliged to do that. You're contracted to do that. You're committed to that. And it doesn't seem like you're setting the world alight by just really working hard in the office. Doesn't seem like a great kind of Christian act. Doesn't seem anything to compare with Jim Elliot laying down his life in the fields of Ecuador. But that is true and genuine Christian living. Mundane faithfulness to the commitments you've made, in that case, to your employer. So faithfulness is costly, faithfulness is definitive, faithfulness is mundane. Fourthly and finally, faithfulness is fitting. Faithfulness is fitting. I love the way our chapter 20 of 1 Samuel begins. Bearing in mind the context here again, just look at the NIV heading for chapter 19. Saul tries to kill David. This is a context in which David is being really, really harassed by Saul. And we read then in verse 1 of chapter 20, "Then David fled from Naioth at Ramah." Where does he go? In this situation where he's harassed, where he's being pursued, where someone wants to take his life, where can he find asylum? Where can he find refuge? Jonathan. Because Jonathan is the man who has made these covenant commitments to him. Again, quoting Derav Davis, he says, "In David's disintegrating world, there was yet one space of sanity, one refuge still intact, Jonathan." And it's a wonderful thing, that, isn't it? A wonderful picture. There was one place he could go because there was one person who had made promises to him, one person who had sworn himself to him. And so however hostile others might be, he knew he could find safety and security with Jonathan. And it's very interesting that there's another passage in the Bible where we see David doing something similar. Where we see David fleeing, as Derav Davis would put it, to the one space of sanity, to the one refuge still intact. Where we see David fleeing to the one person who has made promises to him. Jonathan's not still alive by this point that I'm talking about. I'm talking about Psalm 51. And David's problem here is no longer a persecution problem. It's no longer that Saul is trying to kill him. David's problem here is a moral problem. It's his own heart that's the problem. It's his own behavior that's the problem. He's just a few months earlier committed adultery with Bathsheba. And in that situation, in that crisis, once again, David flees to the one person who has made promises to him. In this case, it's God. And we read then, in Psalm 51, verse 1, him running to God and crying out, "Have mercy on me, O God." Why? This is David who's just sinned against God. David the adulterer. David the lawbreaker. Why should God have mercy on him? "According to your unfailing love." It's the Hebrew word chesed. And it's the same word which occurs so often in the David and Jonathan narrative. Particularly in 1 Samuel 20, in that verse we've already quoted this evening, where David says, Jonathan says to David, "Show me unfailing kindness as long as I live." And it's that Hebrew word chesed. It means more than just affection or love. It means covenant love. Show me loyal love, steadfast love. I think the RSV translates it as. Show me covenant, faithful love. And David then, even in the crisis of his shameful backsliding, could run to one person who had made promises to him and know that he wouldn't be turned away, that God would accept him, not because he deserved it, but because God had made unbreakable commitments and promises to him. "I will be your God, and nothing you can ever do can stop me from being your God. My love is a love that will not let you go." And my point is then that faithfulness in our relationships is ultimately so fitting because it reflects the faithfulness of God himself to us, doesn't it? We should keep our commitments to one another, as David and Jonathan did. Not because it just makes sense in some pragmatic fashion, but because it reflects the faithfulness which God has shown to us. And the fact then that he has made promises to us that are so strong that even when we've sinned against him so desperately, we can still go to him. And we can still plead with him, "Accept me, Lord, because of your chesed, because of your covenant love." We should show it because he has first shown it toward us. And one other thing, and this is perhaps slightly speculative, but isn't it perhaps the case that that David's relationship with Jonathan actually therefore taught David great lessons about his relationship with God. That as David saw Jonathan being so faithful to him, that really illustrated to him and really made vivid to him just how God relates to us. And that's a wonderful thing in itself, isn't it? When our relationships with people help them to understand a bit more what God is like. I think that was the case here. Jonathan's faithfulness to David helped David understand a bit better what God was like. Perhaps helped him all those years later in Psalm 51 to be able to run to God appealing on his covenant love. It's a great thing when our children can learn lessons about what God is like, not only from what we say to them in family devotions, but from what they see in us and how they see us behaving. It's a great thing when our faithfulness toward each other, our willingness to forgive each other, our patience with each other, our care for each other, actually enables us to understand a bit more clearly what God is like. Let's seek to be in our lives living embodiments to each other of the very character of the God we serve. Amen.